Good morning.
Good morning.
I'd like to start this morning with a little anecdote about my connection to Joseph Campbell and how that links to Unitarian Universalism and then ultimately how I'm standing here this morning. A dozen years ago, a dozen years ago, I wanted to publicize a workshop I was going to lead about Joseph Campbell's idea of the hero's journey. A colleague of mine suggested that I should drop off some flyers about my workshop at local UU churches because, she said, UUs were pretty open to Joseph Campbell's ideas. So I set off one Sunday morning with a stack of flyers to the Oakland UU Church. I was not in any way connected with Unitarians at this point. To a UU church in Oakland, and I intended to drop them off and then continue on with my errands for the day. Well, when I got there, I discovered that there was actually a worship service about to begin, and so out of curiosity, I decided to stay and see what UU worship might be like. I found that I enjoyed the service so much that I decided to return the following Sunday, and then the next Sunday, and then the next Sunday, and, well, to make a long story short, I didn't leave. I'd actually discovered a form of religious, communal religious practice, and we could have an entire afternoon about my personal religion, but my communal religious practice is Unitarian Universalism. And that was a great surprise to me, and were it not for Campbell and the hero's journey and the desire to publicize the workshop, I might never actually have discovered that. As a result of teaching classes on mythology at the Oakland Church, I came to the attention of Martha Helming. As most of you know, Martha was the chair of the adult religious education program here, as well as this personal theology series. She invited me here to teach classes on myth and the mythic perspective, and I ended up doing so for nearly a decade. One of those classes was attended by Dick Sherman, as he said. And so he invited me here to come and speak to you this morning. So although Joseph Campbell is the source, the topic of the day, I think he's also the catalyst. We have to give him some additional credit today for that. And I'd also like to say, in particular, what an honor and a joy it is for me to be speaking to you, but from this podium that is dedicated to the memory of my friend Martha. We became very good friends. I'm not sure who was the teacher and who was the student, but Martha was like that. That we are synchronistically at the anniversary of her passing is not something lost on me. So, thank you, Martha. I'd also like to start this morning by telling you a bit about my relationship to mythology in general and to the work of Joseph Campbell in particular. For starters, I've been fascinated by myth and legend ever since I was a child. Classic fairy tales, biblical stories, the Arabian Nights, stories from ancient Egypt, Greek mythology, the tales of King Arthur. These all fascinated me as a child, and then later led to a deep interest as a young adult in the worlds of J.R.R. Tolkien and Ursula Le Guin and Madeleine L'Engle and so many of these other creators of mythic worlds. Then, as I moved into my 20s, my interest in mythic material receded into a sort of hobby, while other more practical concerns, primarily those related to career and relationship, took center stage in my life. That state of affairs lasted into my mid-40s. At that time, like many of my peers, I arrived at that challenging passage called midlife. I felt that, like Dante, I had somehow badly lost my way. I found myself in the middle of the journey of our life, Dante wrote at the beginning of the Inferno, in a dark wood where the straight path was lost. In my case, the detour from the straight path, from the journey I was supposed to be on, involved a 60-hour-plus work week as a middle manager at a high-tech startup. My stress level was high, and though I generally liked the people I worked with, very little in my job description bore any resemblance to anything of meaning or value to me. The catalyst for realizing that I lost my way was a trip my partner and I made to Italy in 1994. The trip was magical, filled with the beauty of great art and architecture, the pleasure of delicious food, and the delight of being in a land where people have actively sought to enjoy themselves for millennia. After a blissful 2 weeks in Italy, I found myself back at my very demanding job, but now with a dawning, screaming awareness that something was terribly wrong with the quality and the direction of my life. Most of all, I was increasingly aware that the deep malaise that I felt had less to do with the nature of the work I was doing than the quality of my spiritual life. Like a lot of modern people, I became disenchanted as an adolescent with the religion of my parents, which in our case was Judaism. Most importantly, I came to have grave doubts about the existence of the God Jews are supposed to believe in and worship. I came to understand that the idea of God I'd grown up with, an omniscient, omnipotent, personal deity who rewards goodness and punishes evil, pretty standard issue, was not sustainable. For starters, I couldn't imagine how such a God would allow such horrors as wars and holocausts to happen. Still, I couldn't dismiss the felt sense I'd also had since childhood of something more than human consciousness, something that transcended my everyday awareness, not as a matter of belief, but rather as a lived experience of something beyond all the words and images and names people used to refer to the divine. Then, around the time I turned 30, I entered a period of what I now called my agnostic phase. I decided I was never going to solve my God problem, so I would stop pondering it and just get on with the practical challenges of adult life. Even so, I never managed to fully dispense with the idea of a divine presence in the world, nor completely relinquish a deep sense of yearning for something beyond the material world and its concerns. That deep sense of yearning that something might rightly be called sacred resurfaced with a vengeance in the months following my return from Italy. Now, I was astute enough to realize that neither conventional psychotherapy nor a traditional form of pastoral counseling were likely to guide me on the journey that lay ahead. That said, I was blessed to encounter a counselor who blended psychology and spirituality via an archetypal approach to human development. Together, we explored the archetypal energies that lay at the core of my story, a narrative that took on both the richness and depth of a dream and the inspired plotting of a classic novel or movie. Inspired by this counselor, I revisited the PBS Joseph Campbell and the Power of Myth television series. While I previously enjoyed watching this series of interviews, I now approach this material from a much more profound and personal perspective. Indeed, I came to understand that my spiritual yearnings had a mythological basis, that myth was the doorway through which I might encounter the experience of the sacred that I had been searching for since childhood. That renewed and reanimated interest in mythology ultimately led to my decision in 1997 to pursue a doctorate in mythological studies at Pacifica Graduate Institute. And as you've already heard, that's the place that Campbell's widow, Jean Erdman, decided to leave all of his papers, his archives, his notes, his audio tapes, his entire life's work. The primary focus of my studies at Pacifica was on the application of the mythic perspective to challenges of both psychological and spiritual development. concerns that were very deep in the work of Joseph Campbell and in his life. Before delving into Campbell's approach to mythology in general and the religious function of mythology in particular, we need to spend a little bit of time answering the larger question of what myth is, why myth has always been part of the human experience, and why myth and the mythic perspective are still relevant today. For most people, most Western people, both reductionistically, materialistically oriented secularists on the one hand, and dogmatically religious fundamentalists on the other, the primary meaning of the word myth in contemporary discourse is synonymous with falsehood. We see this usage of the word myth routinely in common parlance. To illustrate this point, I recently did a search on Google using the phrase, the myth of. And the first 50 hits that came up, of the first 50, 43 used the word myth as in the sense of falsehood. Here's a short selection of some of the references I found. The myth of self-control. The myth of the Old South. The myth of artificial intelligence. The myth of mental illness. The myth of Russian power. And one that I particularly related to, the myth of multitasking. There's even a popular science television program called Mythbusters. Needless to say, whenever I see a commercial for that, I want to turn off the television set. The reason we confuse myth with falsehood is that from a literal point of view, a myth is not literally true. Because our culture is obsessed with propositional truths and hard facts, many people have trouble understanding how something so unscientific and factually untrue as mythology could be of any value. But this attitude reflects more negatively on us than on mythology. It suggests how far removed we are from the stirrings of the soul and how disconnected we have become from the ancient wisdom contained in mythic stories and images. Indeed, as the existential psychologist Rollo May observed, there can be no stronger proof of the impoverishment of our contemporary culture than the popular, though profoundly mistaken, definition of myth as falsehood. On the contrary, rather than conveying any sort of literal factual truth, myths are symbolic and metaphorical stories which contain existential insights and perennial truths about the human condition. Echoing this commonly understood conception of myth in the ancient world, the Roman author Sallust in the first century observed that myths are about things that always, that never were, but always are. That what never were, but always are. Both Western religion and science, in their orthodox forms, have trouble with mythology. Fundamentalist religion, with its dogmatic need to interpret literally and concretely, treats its own mythology as historical truth and all other religious myths as dangerous heresies. Joseph Campbell actually had a wonderful line. He said, one definition of myth is other people's religion. Orthodox science, with its rigid commitment to empirical fact, manifests its own inability to appreciate the kind of truth revealed through metaphor, image, and symbol. Writing about this dual problem, humanistic psychologist David Elkins observes, myths challenge the need of both fundamentalist religion and orthodox science for a well-ordered universe where everything stays in its place. Myths open the door to a world that cannot be predicted or controlled, where truth is more amorphous, ambiguous, multifaceted, relative, and pluralistic. Myths take us out of the world where hard-edged facts lie about us like stones on the ground and leads us deeply into the imaginal sea, which has currents and truths of its own. Another prevalent misconception about mythology is the idea that mythology is little more than primitive science. Well, there's some truth to this because mythology did at times serve this function. The origins and purpose of mythology go far deeper than this superficial understanding suggests. In fact, a particular view of myth as primitive science is a good example of how contemporary Western people impose our modes and biases and scientific worldviews on ancient and indigenous cultures, making them appear less than perfect and crude, and making them little more than precursors of our presumably more enlightened way of understanding. This is more an indication of our own deep-seated cultural ethnocentrism than a truthful analysis of the origins and purposes of myth. In viewing mythology as superstition or an inferior form of science, we dismiss its relevance to the modern age, and so long as such attitudes prevail, we will not be able to see the true value of mythology as a path to the sacred and a way to nurture the soul. Yet another important distinction we need to understand if we to truly appreciate both the nature and the value of the mythic perspective is the one historians make between two different modes of consciousness, modes the ancient Greeks called mythos and logos. Both forms of knowing were considered to be essential and were regarded as complementary ways of arriving at truth, though each had its own unique area of competence. Mythos was regarded as the primary, primordial form of knowing, the oldest, concerned as it was with the perennial and the unchanging in human existence. Mythos looks back to the beginnings of things, to the foundations of things, and to the deepest levels of human consciousness. It's not concerned with practical, mundane matters, but with questions of meaning. A society or culture's mythos provides people with a larger context and perspective for understanding their day-to-day lives and experiences by directing their attention to that which is eternal and universal. Mythos is also rooted in what we would today call the unconscious mind. The many and varied mythological narratives, which were not intended to be taken literally, are in essence an ancient form of psychology. When storytellers and bards told tales about heroes descending into the underworld and struggling through labyrinths and battling monsters, they were bringing to light otherwise hidden and obscure regions of the subconscious realm. While not accessible to purely rational investigation, the subconscious realm nevertheless exerts a profound effect on our conscious behavior and experience. Ironically, as the psychologist Carl Jung observed, it's precisely the dearth of mythic awareness in modern society that required the development of psychoanalytic theories and therapies to help us cope with the darker, messier contents of the inner world. As essential as mythos was to our pre-modern ancestors, logos, on the other form of understanding which evolved in ancient Greece, was regarded as equally important. The understanding brought via logos is rational, pragmatic, discursive, and scientific in both nature and purpose. It's the form of consciousness that enables people to function effectively in the world. We use logos whenever we need to make things happen, get something accomplished, or persuade others to adopt a particular course of action. Unlike mythos, logos must correspond directly to facts and relate to external realities of the mundane world if it is to be effective. Unlike mythos, which looks imaginarily back to beginnings and foundations, logos forges on into the future, trying always to find the new, building on old insights, inventing something novel. By the 18th century, however, the peoples of Europe and America had achieved such astonishing success in science and technology that they began to think that logos was the only means of truth they needed and began to entirely discount mythos as false and superstitious. The effect of this triumph of logos over mythos has, on the one hand, led to the evolution of modern religious fundamentalism, and on the other hand, to a kind of nihilistic existentialism in which nothing is deemed to be sacred. In considering the relationship of mythos and logos in the pre-modern world, both were regarded as indispensable. As historian of religion Karen Armstrong writes, each would be impoverished without the other. Yet the two were essentially distinct, and it was held dangerous to confuse mythical with rational discourse. They had separate jobs to do. Myth was not reasonable. Its narratives were not supposed to be demonstrated empirically. It provided the context of meaning that made our practical lives worthwhile. Logos had its limitations, too. It could not assuage human pain or sorrow. Rational arguments could make no sense of tragedy. Logos could not answer questions about the ultimate value of human life. A scientist could make things work more efficiently and discover wonderful new facts about the physical universe, but he could not explain the meaning of life. That was the preserve of myth, concludes Armstrong. In the effort to describe what myth is and is meant to do, perhaps the most poetic definition is the one offered by Joseph Campbell himself on the very first page of The Hero with a Thousand Faces, the 1949 bestseller that launched not only Campbell's early fame, but the profoundly influential idea of the hero's journey. In that work, Campbell writes, "It would not be too much to say that myth is the secret opening through which the inexhaustible energies of the cosmos pour into human psychological and cultural manifestation. Religions, philosophies, arts, the social forms of primitive and historic man, the very dreams that blister sleep boil up from the basic magic ring of myth." He also ends that first chapter of that work with a cogent observation about the continuing relevance of myth to modern life, wryly observing that the latest incarnation of Oedipus and the continued romance of Beauty and the Beast stand this afternoon on the corner of 42nd Street and 5th Avenue waiting for the light to change. Since Campbell is the central figure of my talk this morning, I think a little background on the man and his work is in order at this point. To start with, Campbell was born in 1904 to a middle-class Irish Roman Catholic family in White Plains, New York. His earliest years were largely unremarkable, but then, when he was 7 years old, his father took him to see Buffalo Bill's Wild West show at Madison Square Garden. That evening turned out to be one of the high points of Campbell's life. Although the Cowboys were clearly intended to be the show's heroes, Campbell was far more interested, indeed mesmerized, by the figure of the American Indian, as he would later write, with his ear to the ground and a look of special knowledge in his eyes. Though Campbell continued to practice his family's Catholic faith until well into his 20s, he became consumed with Native American culture, and one might say that his mythological worldview was significantly shaped by the dynamic tension between these two mythological perspectives. On the one hand, he was immersed in the ritual symbols and traditions of the Irish Catholic Church. On the other, he was obsessed with indigenous people's direct experience of the sacred. Later, in college and graduate school, that mythological tension between his experience of Catholicism and his interest in non-Christian spirituality manifested as a fascination with the Celtic roots of the stories about the Holy Grail in the Arthurian legend. In 1924, while on a steamship journey to Europe, Campbell met Jiddu Krishnamurti, the young, charismatic leader of the Theosophical Society, an encounter that deepened Campbell's interest in mysticism and mystical traditions, as well as in Asian religious traditions. After earning degrees in English and medieval literature at Columbia University, Campbell went on to study in Europe for 2 years, where he was exposed to a whole range of modernists, from Pablo Picasso and Paul Klee to James Joyce and Thomas Mann. While in Europe, Campbell also encountered the work of both Sigmund Freud and Carl Jung, both of whom would greatly influence his understanding of myth. Collectively, all of these encounters would eventually lead Campbell to theorize that myths are the creative products of the human psyche, creative manifestation of humankind's universal need to explain psychological, social, cosmological, and spiritual realities. One of Campbell's core insights about mythology is the idea that myth serves 4 principal functions for humankind. A theoretical construct he first completely formulated in 1964 in the final volume of The Masks of God, his monumental 4-volume history of the evolution of mythology from ancient times to the modern world. The first of these 4 functions delineated by Campbell, and the one we're most concerned about today, he describes as metaphysical and religious in nature. Describing this first and foremost and most ancient function of myth, Campbell writes that, quote, "It awakens and supports a sense of awe before the mystery of being and induces a realization that behind the surface of the phenomenal world, there is a transcendent mystery source." This is an essential idea for Campbell, and one we will continue exploring later this morning. The second of the 4 functions of myth, Campbell describes as being cosmological in nature, the mythic domain most connected to science. Cosmological myths present an imaginal, symbolic map in order for us of the order of the cosmos and our relationship to it. As Campbell expressed it, this mythic function shows us the shape of the universe, but in such a way that the mystery still shines through. Cosmological myth, Campbell tells us, must always correspond to the actual experience and knowledge of the culture, and as a result, changes radically over time. For example, Campbell frequently wrote about the fallacy of the pre-modern cosmological model of an earthly realm sandwiched between an infinitely heavenly realm above and an infinitely infernal one below, a model he jokingly called the 3-layer cake cosmology. As our scientific knowledge about the universe evolves, so must the myths, symbols, and metaphors we use to portray the universe. That said, the scientific facts about nature and the functioning of the cosmos alone lack the capacity to instill in us a mythic sense of wonder and awe about our place in the cosmos. For that, we need storytellers to refract those facts into symbolic and metaphorical narratives. When looking for examples of contemporary cosmological mythology, good examples can be found from, of course, the work of Carl Sagan, as well as the cosmologist Thomas Berry in his book, The Dream of the Earth, and of Brian Swim's book, The Universe is a Green Dragon. How mythological. Right here in our own UU tradition, one might check out the work of 2 educators, Michael Dowd and Connie Barlow, and their traveling show. Theirs is they talk about the mythic vision of the history of the universe, simply called The Great Story. I had the privilege of listening to them present their story, and it is magical. It's deeply rooted in science, and you walk away with a sense of terribly awesome energy about our cosmos. The third of myth's 4 functions, according to Campbell, is sociological in nature, intended to support and validate the moral order of the society out of which it grows. Of the 4 functions served by myth, Campbell clearly said that this was the one in greatest disarray. Often asked what the new social mythology of humanity would be, Campbell declined to answer because he said, one can no more predict a myth than what one will dream tonight. Nevertheless, he believed that one of the core sacred symbols of that emerging social mythology would be the image of the Earth seen from space, a world without borders or boundaries, one home shared by all who live on her. The fourth function of myth predicated by Campbell is psychological. Myths show us how to live a human life, carrying the individual through the various stages and crises of life, from childhood dependency to the responsibilities of maturity to the reflection of old age, and finally to death. When myth serves this function, it helps people grasp the unfolding of their lives with integrity and guides us toward the living out of our full potential as individuals. Given his interest in the psychological work of Carl Jung, it's not surprising that 40 years he was engaged with Jung. It's not surprising that Jung's model, evolutionary model of the human psyche through a lifetime, the process he called individuation, deeply fascinated Campbell. And one can see that fascination directed into Campbell's own model of human evolutionary process, the hero's journey. While Campbell's four functions of myth make a seemingly clear distinction between the religious function of myth and the function focused on the psychological, in reality, a particularly compelling quality of Campbell's work stems from his blending of the mystical dimension of the religious function with contemporary psychological ideas regarding the nature of the unconscious. Indeed, in practice, Campbell recognizes that the religious and psychological domains of human life are interwoven into one complex, ever-evolving tapestry of which mythic consciousness is both the weaver and the loom. To fully understand Campbell's concept of the religious function of myth, we also need to know something about his connection to a particular mystical perspective. Partly derived from his deep study of Hindu and Buddhist religious ideas and mythology, his spiritual orientation also was consistent with the principal tenets of what have come to be called the perennial philosophy, a metaphysical perspective focused on seeking a universal frame for understanding mystical experience. What is the perennial philosophy? Well, in a nutshell, it's the belief that at the core of all great religions and wisdom traditions is the same mystical experience of ultimate reality, and that all the surface theological disagreements, all the different religious myths, all the different names for that ultimate reality basically amount to spiritual window dressing. More than 20 years earlier, in Hero with a Thousand Faces, Campbell first expressed this sense of a universal doctrine underlying his vision of myth, observing that all the visible structures of the world, all the things and all the beings, are the effects of a ubiquitous power out of which they arise, which supports them and fills them during the period of their manifestation, and back into which they must ultimately dissolve. 40 years later, at the end of his career, in the television series The Power of Myth, Campbell reiterates his integration of the core vision of the perennial philosophy with his understanding of the nature of mythology, observing simply that the basic theme of all mythology is that there is an invisible plane supporting the visible one. As I noted a moment ago, another key element of the mystical orientation implicit in Campbell's approach to the religious function of myth is his emphasis on the profound interrelatedness and ultimate oneness of the metaphysical and psychological dimensions. A number of commentators on Campbell have written about the influence of his bringing together the mystical metaphysics and depth psychology in the creation of his work. While writing about this synthesis of the metaphysical and the psychological in Campbell's work, mythologist Robert Siegel tells us, because Campbell interprets myth psychologically as well as metaphysically, myth becomes a tool for celebrating both the oneness of the unconscious with everyday consciousness, as well as the oneness of ultimate reality with ordinary reality. Writing in the same vein, religious studies scholar Lonnie Cleaver observes of Campbell's teaching, "Stripped of their literal and historical posturings, the myths of humankind give expression and form to those two mysterious voids which come from life and to which it returns, the unconscious self and the unlimited universe." In fact, one of Campbell's books is called The Outer Reaches of Inner Space. Gives you some sense of what he's talking about. Described by Campbell as the great key to the understanding of myth is the recognition that although the two worlds, the divine and the human, are pictured as distinct from one another, these two worlds are actually one. Once we grasp the significance of this recognition, Campbell writes, we learn that the realm of the gods is a forgotten dimension of the everyday world we know. Expressing this fundamental tenet of his orientation to myth, in other words, Campbell says, myths have sprung from the psyche and point back to the psyche, and that anyone seriously turning within will, in fact, rediscover their references in himself. The ultimate implication of this profound interconnection of the religious and the psychological dimensions of myth can be seen in Campbell's observation that all the gods are within us. Also critical to an understanding of Campbell's approach to religious myth are two often quoted interrelated concepts essential to all of his work. The first of these two interconnected ideas states that if symbols and stories are to function effectively as myth, they need to be transparent to transcendent. In fact, when he was talking to Bill Morris about it, he said, transparent to transcendent. This concept, adopted by Campbell from the work of the German mystic and depth psychologist Carl Fried Graf Durkheim, warns that mythic stories, symbols, and metaphors must not be allowed to become opaque to the mystical consciousness and essence to which they refer. So, how does mythic material become opaque? Through literalizing and historicizing that which is meant to be understood symbolically and metaphorically. When mythic material becomes opaque to transcendence, specific cultural, ethnic, historical, or sectarian interpretations block the power of such material to transport us beyond the boundaries of rational consciousness. When mythic material becomes opaque to transcendence, its universal, spiritual, and metaphysical significance is obscured. Campbell states the consequence of literalizing our myths, in particular religious myths, very clearly when he warns us that any god who is not transparent to transcendence is an idol, and its worship is idolatry. The second of these core interrelated concepts within Campbell's work states that if mythic stories and images are allowed to continue to remain transparent to the transcendent realm, then they are able to function metaphorically as the masks of God. It's critical to understand here that the God referred to in this phrase is not the personal deity of the monotheistic traditions, but rather points to the mystical idea of the God beyond God, as the medieval mystic Meister Eckhart named it. Alternatively described as the ground of being and cosmic consciousness, this mystical understanding of divinity is also known as Brahman in Hinduism, the Tao in Taoism, and Ein Sof in the Jewish Kabbalah. In Campbell's view, human consciousness requires symbolic interfaces with transcendence. We need those symbolic interfaces, masks in the form of particular mythic images and stories that speak effectively both to the psychological and metaphysical dimensions of awareness. yet always pointing indirectly beyond themselves to that ultimate and perennial reality. One potential source of confusion regarding Campbell's means to what Campbell means to imply by the phrase transparent to transcendent, indeed a potential source of confusion regarding his whole frame of reference for the sacred, lies in not fully comprehending Campbell's use of the term transcendence. That this term is crucial to Campbell's approach to myth can be seen in the simple declaration he made that the word transcendence is the key word for mythology. That said, it's important to note here that what Campbell refers to transcendence, he's not using the term as it is typically used in Western theology, where transcendence typically refers to the idea of divinity transcending the phenomenal world of time and space. Campbell is referring to transcendence as it is commonly understood in Hinduism, Buddhism, and Taoism as meaning that which is beyond all concepts and that which is beyond all forms of thinking. For Campbell, far from being outside the world of time and space, the transcendent mystery source to which it refers is always accessible right here, right now. It is essential to recognize that, in keeping with the metaphysical framework of the perennial philosophy, Campbell never views divine reality, both the transcendence to which the myths must remain transparent and the divine energy behind the many masks, as any sort of differentiated personal divinity. Rather, as Phil Cousineau observes, for Campbell, every deity is a metaphor, a mask for the ultimate mystery ground, the transcendent energy source of the universe that is also the mysterious source of your own life. In this regard, Campbell writes, the gods are agents, manifestations, or functionaries of an energy that transcends all conceptualization, and as such are not the source of the energy, but rather the agents of it. To illustrate this critical distinction between the transcendent energy source of the universe and its agents, Campbell often used the humble metaphor of an electric light bulb, and electric light. When observing the lighting in a room, we can say the lights, plural, are on, or we can say the light, singular, is on. The former expression refers to the bulbs, and when the latter, to the light itself. If the light bulbs burn out, the maintenance person is not upset by this fact, as the bulb was only a temporary agent of the light source by which the room was illuminated. What is important is the source of the light, not its temporary, fragile vehicle symbolized by the light bulb. For Campbell, it is essential that we identify with the light rather than the light bulb, with the transcendent source rather than with the agents of that source, and with the transcendent which we glimpse behind the transparencies of myth. Also central to Campbell's approach to the religious dimension of myth is his idea that myth is meant to function as both stimulus and vehicle for the direct experience of the sacred. Indeed, one of the most distinctive general features of Campbell's work is his repeated insistence that the power of myth resides specifically in its ability to stimulate personal experience of a profoundly existential nature regarding the sacred dimension of life. In particular, Campbell continually links myth with the experience of two interwoven mysteries connected to the sacred: the mystical experience of the mystery of transcendent reality and the existential experience of the mystery of being passionately in the phenomenal world. Speaking of this experience of a mystery that is simultaneously mystical and existential, Campbell tells myth in the Power of Myth television series, "People say that what we're seeking is the meaning of life. I don't think that's what we're really seeking. I think that what we're seeking is an experience of being alive so that our life experiences on the purely physical plane will have resonances within our own innermost being and reality. so that we actually feel the rapture of being alive. Regarding the ability of myth to direct one to such an experience of transcendence, Campbell observes that mythic symbols and narratives have the power to deliver more than just an intellectual concept, for such is their inner character, that they provide a sense of actual participation in the realization of transcendence. Related to myth's ability to help us engage the transcendent realm is another phrase that Campbell was fond of quoting. A Sanskrit phrase which comes from the Upanishads, one of the central texts of the Hindu tradition. That phrase is tat tvam asi, meaning thou art that, or you yourself are it. Campbell saw this phrase as unlocking the ultimate insight, not only of the Asian wisdom traditions, but ultimately of the religious function of mythology as a whole. The core of that insight is the awareness of the inherent identity of our own deepest, highest consciousness with the transcendent source of all consciousness, our identity with the metaphorical light that shines out of each of our metaphorical light bulbs. In much the same way, this teaching urges us to seek the truth that shines out of the world's religious myths rather than worshiping the myths themselves. In the conventional orthodox versions of the monotheistic traditions, there is no recognition of the possibility of such an experience of identity with the transcendent source or ground of being. Indeed, such identification with the divine would be considered heretical in orthodox monotheism. What is emphasized instead in the monotheistic traditions is achieving and maintaining a relationship with a personal creator God who is separate from us as well as separate from the world he is believed to have created. In the Jewish tradition, that relationship is dependent on the special covenant Yahweh made with the people of Israel and through adherence to the teachings and commandments of the Torah. In Christianity, that relationship is maintained by believing in the resurrection of the historical Jesus and membership in the church, the institution ordained to be the mediator between the human and the divine. In other words, the monotheistic faith are religions of relationship, relationship to a divinity outside of ourselves and outside of creation. In contrast, the ultimate goal of religions like Hinduism, Buddhism, and Taoism is to bring us to an experience of our own spiritual identity that is one with the mystery of all being and the source of all consciousness. Understanding the proper relationship between mythic stories and symbols and the ultimate consciousness, which is both their referent and their source, is, in Campbell's view, crucial to appreciating the religious function of mythology. For this reason, he declares, what is holy and to be sought is not the promise of any given myth or the claims of any inherited god, but the living source of all the myths and all the gods. The wisdom of this guidance is particularly urgent today as we confront the serious postmodern dilemma of how to approach religious renewal in an age dominated by dangerous, divisive, dogmatic religious fundamentalisms on the one hand and soul-deadening, materialistically oriented secularism on the other. Throughout his long career, Campbell taught that direct experience of the symbolic power of myth, and most especially of religious myth, could serve as a viable religious alternative for those contemporary people who could no longer find access to the sacred through traditional religious means. In my own studies and in my life, I have experienced the truth of these teachings. Indeed, I have come to understand that my own deep spiritual yearnings truly do have a mythological basis, and that myth is, was, and will always be for me the doorway through which I experience the divine that I had been seeking since childhood.
Okay. Thank you, Richard. Thank you.
One other thing that I'd like to point out. I didn't go into this in depth here, but it's really important to understand that myth, as Campbell's talking about, are not simply all those ancient stories. Myth actually is better understood as mythic rather than myth. Any story can take on a mythic dimension. And in fact, for 9 years, I taught a class here called The Power of Myth at the Movies. And any of you who are in those classes understand that those movies are profound myths and have powerful, the ability to do everything that he's talking about. So just want to be clear about that.
Okay. Hands and the roving microphone will visit you.
Yeah.
Oh, Ray. Sorry.
As a science fiction novelist, I wonder if you would agree with me that science fiction provides a new and better mythological vision for the people of today.
I would agree with new. I'm not sure I would agree with better. Certainly new, and it very much is. Certainly new, absolutely new, and it's, you know... Old forms disappear, new forms take their place, and the divine energy flows into the new form. And absolutely, I didn't mention Heinlein, I didn't mention a lot of other writers that I was into as much as I was Tolkien, so I absolutely acknowledge the mythic nature of science fiction. Yes.
Thank you very much. While you were talking, I suddenly had a vision of you, of Joe Campbell as a bridge builder between vertical and horizontal, between religions, between countries, and the oneness of humankind. He was very, very important for our time and age. But you didn't mention his wife.
Well, his wife didn't have anything to do with the religious function of myth. That's why I didn't spend much time with that. But his wife was terribly, terribly important. Jane Erdman. Yeah, I did mention that she left his material to Pacifica, which was a great gift, yes. But for him, dance was mythic. So, yes.
Hi, Richard. Thank you. That was really wonderful. I want to ask you about your thoughts on Unitarian Universalism because of the way that we come at the logos part of ourselves. And we look at some of these figures that are gods or spiritual figures in trying to take out their energy of the fundamentalism. We eliminate them entirely. And then they
become sort of washed out versions of themselves.
And we seem to turn our face away instead of looking deeply at the mythic purpose of you know, those particular gods. Can you speak to that? Because I'm really feeling, you know, as you know, co-chair of membership, and I talk to people, they can't grab something in Unitarian Universalism, and it's that sense of the sacred that you so well articulated.
Well, it's interesting because a number of my mythological archetypal friends, the communities that I'm part of, always seem to be surprised by the fact that I've adopted Unitarian Universalism as my communal spiritual practice, because it seems to them that it's very intellectual and there's no space in there for vision, dream, story. And I say, it's what you bring to it. It's a nice blank canvas to which you can bring a great many things, and I like that. I don't know if any of you are aware, but I'm a member of actually the Live Oak Unitarian Universalist Fellowship in Alameda. We're a lay-led congregation, and so we create our own worship. I preach on a regular basis, and you better believe I bring the material that matters to me to the table. But UUism in itself is not a mythically oriented tradition. That doesn't mean it doesn't have access to and can't draw on it. The service that we had, this past worship service, was actually about universalism, right? And the idea of God is love. And so we were using some language that was a little less intellectual and talking about the relationship of the holy to the human, right? And I was very glad that we did that. But, You know, the well, for example, I talked about the two educators of the great story who are definitely part of the Yu tradition. Bringing them in, bringing in more dance, bringing in more art, telling more stories. These are the ways that you can engage people in whatever form. But Unitarian Universalism basically is a blank slate, in a sense. You got to bring something to it, or there's not going to be... Well, don't reject what's being brought to it and don't prejudge what you find. But it is, in a sense, a do-it-yourself religion, even though we're all here doing it ourselves together, right? Yes.
Richard, hello. My name is Ryan. Thank you for your share. A number of things really resonated with me. Universe is the Green Dragon, particularly. I noticed that... you mentioned a lot of like Templar legacy and the Grail, but didn't mention anything about assassins or Islam or Book of Thoth. And I wonder what your position is on things of that nature.
There is mythology in all the monotheistic traditions, although it's less welcomed in some of them than others. The Jewish tradition, for example, has a tradition called Midrash. Midrash is about the reinterpretation of stories, right? Making them more relevant to us. So there's some opening to that. Christianity, a little bit less. If you're an Orthodox Christian, the story of Jesus is not just a story. And I don't even mean just a story, that it is the story that is historically, factually true, the only story. Right, Islam has its own stories, but generally speaking, is a tradition that doesn't seem to be as open to a mythological understanding as some of the others. Where you see it most is in the Sufi tradition within Islam. The Sufis are great storytellers, and boy, do they understand the nature of myth.
Could you elaborate a little on the structure of the human brain and logos and mythos?
Well, you know,
part of our hemisphere is verbal, but the other half is not. And things like empathy and love and altruism might be nonverbal. And the only way we reach them is by myth rather than logos.
But stories are verbal. Stories are verbal. I've been reading a really interesting book called The Master and His Disciple. And I wish I could remember the author's name, but...
Ian McGilchrist.
It's a tome. It's a wonderful book. He is taking a step back because there was a lot of nonsense that was put out in the 70s about the hemispheres of the brain. You know, one's about love, one's about thinking, just generalizations and nonsense. We now neurologically know aren't true. Except for speech, virtually all the functions of the brain exist in both hemispheres. But they exist for very different reasons. That's the point he's making in the book. He quotes Einstein, who said, "Imagination is humankind's greatest gift, and reason is its servant. We have honored the servant and forgotten the gift." Right? And that the imagination part, that function, the unity of consciousness, the understanding, the mythic dimension. So what I'm saying is I absolutely agree with you that it's that right hemisphere, right? It's the right hemisphere that is the source of the mythic and the imaginal, the symbolic. That's where it arises, but it uses all the same brain functions that the other side uses to solve problems and answer questions. So there is clearly some kind of a hemispheric difference that myth does seem to relate to, myth and symbol, for sure.
So I'm thinking of Carl Jung's Red Book.
Yes.
And your acknowledgement of familiarity with it then leads me to ask, was it part of his personal spiritual practice, and does it have a connection to your personal spiritual practice?
Well, you know, in the introduction to
Symbols of Transformation, which is the book that ultimately forced the split with Freud, because he talks about the collective unconscious in that book. He writes in the introduction that he realized in the middle of his life that he didn't know what his myth was, right? And that he made it the task of tasks to discover what his myth was. And he went back and looked at a lot of things in his childhood, and the whole tower he built in Bowlingen is part of that. The Red Book has a lot to do, I think, with the break with Freud and how he came through that. But there's a lot of material in the Red Book. The answer to your question in a nutshell is he was talking about his personal mythology in every way in that book. And I talked about myths and stories. I left out dreams. I know Jeremy Taylor is somebody who comes and teaches here often. The collective unconscious has many modes. I would not say that Jung's mythology, personal mythology, is mine, but I do understand that the model that he came up with, the model of individuation, very much feels like it is alive in my life. The work that I do, I do a kind of mythic counseling work where I help people explore the archetypal and mythic dimensions of their stories. Each and every one of us has a deep, complex mythology underlying the day-to-day understanding of who we are.
I wonder if you could take a myth of your choosing, a story that is not literally true, and explain what meaning or what use it has.
Well, I'm not sure this one will work for all of you, but the story of Job in the Hebrew Bible was enormously fascinating to Jung, but it was a particularly problematical story for me. When I think about the story that pretty much finished off my early relationship with Judaism, it was the story of Job, right? As I read that story as a young man, I read a story about a guy who had lost everything. Forget about the wager business, you know. I mean, that turns out, by the way, that God and the devil having a wager, right? That was something that was added on by other scribes later on to make the story more clearly moralistic, right? The story itself, guy loses everything. His friends come and tell him, well, he must have done something wrong because otherwise all this terrible stuff wouldn't happen to him. And he says, no, really, I didn't do anything wrong. And then all of a sudden, God shows up. And God says to the friends, you're misleading my good servant Job. In other words, they're wrong. He didn't do anything. What they're telling him is wrong. He actually hadn't done anything, right? Now, he still held on to the idea that even though he couldn't think of what it was, he must have done something. There's something wrong here, right? But when he figures out that, this was not some kind of punishment. This was just like the way it was, right? Job does the thing that I would very much wanted to do when I was at that age, start screaming and yelling at God saying, you know, F you, what kind of bullshit is that, you know? Well, I walked away from that story for a very, very long time, and only after I came through the doorway of myth and came back to actually re-examining my own tradition, my relationship to Judaism is much richer now than it ever was when I was a kid. I just don't practice Judaism. What I realized was that the end of the book that pissed me off, and what happens at the end, for those of you who may or may not remember, is that God manifests as the universe, right? Like the universe. And it's like, you know, he's just completely overwhelmed. And what he does is he falls on his face and he says, "Ooh, I did not understand. I had no idea. I'm so sorry." Right? Now, as a kid, that story, that didn't work for me. That just did not work for me. It was like, you know, God pulling some, you know, enormous rabbit out of a hat in order to, you know, change the discussion. When in fact, the universe did the ultimate act of compassion and filled the man with radical awe and wonder at a situation he could never fully comprehend because it was beyond his possibility to comprehend. That didn't mean that it lacked meaning. It just meant that he needed to get on with his life with the understanding that the universe was unfolding as it needed to. Now, that totally, for me, that sort of brought me back in a way to the Jewish faith. It brought me in as hard as it pushed me out when I couldn't deal with it back at the age of 16.
Actually, I think Winnie.
Well, I just want to say, Richard, it's good to have you back after having taken a number of your classes. But one practical question. Paper that you presented this morning, is there some way to get a copy of that? I'd love to give it to all of my grandkids.
There's two things. One, I'm about to launch. I've been resisting talking about another biblical story, the Jonah story. You know, you have this sense that you're being sent somewhere and you're going, no, I'm not going. I'm sorry. I'm not going there. Right? I've been told for a very, very long time that I should be writing and putting ideas out to more than just my clients or the few people I teach. And so I'm about to launch a new website called faithinthejourney.com. And there's a sign up sheet back there. And if you put your name in the sign-up sheet, and maybe just put a little note next to it, I'll be happy to send you a copy of the text.
You mentioned endings in stories, and I'm thinking about, do myths have to have an ending? I watched a movie last night called Wakefield. Have you seen that? It's a movie about a man who gets disenchanted with his life in the big world, whatever. And he has a family. He has a wife and two daughters. But he decides one night not to go home. Instead, he goes into his garage, or into the attic above his garage. And he lives there for like months. And he comes to all these sort of mythic philosophical conclusions, and then the story ends with him shaving, because he becomes like a homeless person, you know, and he decides in the end to shave and, you know, put his good clothes on again, and he goes home, he walks through the door, and he says, I'm home, and then the story ends. It's like you don't know what is going to happen. You know, it's like I was fascinated by the story and all the thoughts that he was having while he was out, but I was looking for an ending.
Yeah, we have this illusion that narratives have to have beginnings, middles, and endings, but the postmodern understanding of storytelling tells us maybe not so much, that it's an addiction we have. The bottom line is that every myth ends with "and then," because we don't know what comes next. There is no end to the story. And Campbell once said, all stories end once, or begin once upon a time, and none of them end, and they all lived happily ever after, right?
Well, I figured you're supposed to put your own myth into the story.
Well, we're always being asked to read how that story relates to our story. I just finished looking at a wonderful book by a classic scholar named Mendelssohn, I can't remember his first name, who teaches the Odyssey, and his father was old and kind of crotchety, and they'd had a problematical relationship and whatever, but he decides against his better judgment to go on a voyage to visit the places that the Odyssey is supposed to be set in. So they go on this journey together. You have to understand that the Odyssey is a story about a boy trying to find his father, right, as much as it is about a man trying to get home, right? And so, you know, he tells the story of the Odyssey, but also in terms of you know, his story, his father, the dynamic that exists between them, and how the energy of Homer's story could tell them things they didn't understand about their story, but they now understand, right? One of the reasons that my own mythology I call Faith in the Journey is that a journey is all about the journey. It's never about the destination. There is no destination. Anything that looks like a destination is a stop-off point between the next leg of the journey. It's a journey all the way down, right? And so to look for endings or where things seem clear is sometimes not what myth is for. Myth is supposed to open us up to the not knowing as much as the clear, oh, that's it. Yes? Oh, sorry.
Let's see, one of the great myth makers of this century, Trump, is able to reach people through the myths he makes up.
Yes.
For instance, that Obama is from Africa.
And that's a myth as in the sense of a falsehood. It's not actually a myth. It's a lie. But people are believing his lie.
Myths can be lies, can't they?
No. A myth has to be at least metaphorically true.
Because through stories like that, he's able to communicate to a level of belief that his beliefs about black people.
Yes.
Without talking about that.
Well, I didn't.
Everyone knows what he's talking
sure.
about, that blacks are dark. Dangerous people.
Well, I could have had a whole nother lecture on archetype and how archetype and myth are related. He is using archetypes. He's using them, however, as stereotypes. If you take an archetype and you stretch it out of shape and make it ridiculous, an archetype, you get a stereotype. And stereotypes are very powerful, right? So he does know how to use, I would say, mythic material, but in this very devious, shadow-oriented kind of way.
So this could be our last question. No, you will be our last question. And please remember, those of you who can, are willing and able to help empty out this room.
And
great.
Also my sign-up sheet, if you're interested in getting no news of when my blog and my website get launched, I'd be delighted to share it with you.
I just wanted to point out one thing, since you brought up the Odyssey in answer to this lady's point about Wakefield. The way the Odyssey ends with him he's supposed to go out and continue journeying over land, right, after returning home from the whole journey. And I remember the first time reading the Odyssey just going, Jesus! Like, what? Right. You know, so.
It's all journey. There's no destination. Yeah. The destination is always a mirage.